The war in Yemen has experienced a back-to-back truce, badly needed one, given the humanitarian catastrophe in that country. So bad that the Red Cross has said that two-thirds of Yemenis are deprived of basic health care in unimaginable horror. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this unimaginable horror, the U.S. complicity in this war. And even though the truce has been broken by the Saudis on more than one occasion, the reports that the U.S. may continue arms sales to the kingdom. Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Yousef Mowry, who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, the founder and editor of the independent news website, Multipolarista, Ben Norton, who joins us from Managua.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ben Norton, let me first start with you. We are looking at the fact that you have a humanitarian situation unfolding in the degree that it is. That's no surprise. But given at this point, we're talking about how the Red Cross says unimaginable horror and that two-thirds of Yemeni people are deprived of basic health care, why hasn't there been any headway made in that arena, given the fact that we're looking at somewhat of a truce that's now been held back-to-back? We're looking at 4 months of it now, roughly.
Well, the answer is because it's in the strategic interests of the West to continue this war after more than 6 years now. We see that the Joe Biden administration is trying to improve its relations with Saudi Arabia and essentially telling Riyadh that it's going to be able to continue waging this war. Now, Joe Biden has repeatedly claimed he wants to end the war, but the reality is that it's in the West's continued interest to support Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and continue providing weapons and military support. And of course, if this were another country waging war on Yemen, like Russia, I think there would be an international outrage that was led by the West. But because it's the West that's backing this war on Yemen, and because the U.S. dominates media narratives and uses its political power to pressure other countries into silence, there's very little discussion of the fact that the people in Yemen are suffering from the worst humanitarian catastrophe on Earth. According to the United Nations, more than 370,000 Yemenis have died in this war, and that's a conservative estimate. And again, we have to ask why. Well, the answer is very clear. It's because the West is backing this war, and according to the West, anything that they want to do is supposedly justified.
Well, you're there, Yousef Mowry, in Sana'a, and when you take a look at the way that Yemenis speak about the West, as our guest there talks about, what West are they referring to that's basically unleashed through the Saudi-led coalition the horrors that is unfolding? Do they blame Saudi Arabia only? Do they blame the U.S.? Who are they blaming?
All of the above. That's who the Yemeni people are blaming. In fact, the international community, any country that is not speaking out against the Saudi coalition and U.S.'s continuous propensity to want to expand over, even if it means spilling the blood of tens of thousands of innocent people. Any country that's not speaking out or is remaining silent to the genocide that's taking place in Yemen, that's what the Yemeni people are blaming, but primarily Saudi Arabia, and of course its U.S. allies, right? You have Saudi Arabia, who's been receiving billions and billions of dollars worth of military aid from the U.S., and the Yemeni people have experienced the reality of what those weapons, what the repercussion of Saudi Arabia having those weapons is going to be. And that's going to lead into the death of tens of thousands of more innocent Yemenis. So again, to answer your question, anybody who is not speaking out against Saudi Arabia, against the U.S. for its continuous atrocities on Yemen, they should be held accountable and they should be blamed, right? Also, the U.N., the U.N. Security Council, any U.N. entity that's, I was here last week and, we did an interview about the humanitarian crisis in the country. And, we're throwing numbers of tens of thousands of innocent people dying, thousands and thousands of innocent children starving to death because of the blockade. And you have, Amnesty International, you have the International Red Cross, the U.N. all speaking out and, basically proclaiming that they want to help alleviate the humanitarian crisis. But that's not the fact. That's not the reality, because all they really want to do is, use the case, the humanitarian case in Yemen, to justify, making money, to justify getting donations from their sponsors, their donors. If they really wanted to end the suffering in Yemen, they would call on Saudi Arabia, call on the UN to lift the strangling blockade. The people are starving on the ground because of the blockade. Basic necessities is not able to enter the country. That's not because the Yemeni people are poor. That's not because Yemen doesn't have enough natural resources to feed its people. It's simply because there's an insidious blockade being imposed by the U.S., by the U.N., and the international community, who are turning a blind eye to the atrocities that are taking place. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine, on the other hand, Amnesty International, the U.N., every country has condemned Russia, and they're claiming this is a Russian invasion, and Russia is killing innocent people, and Russia is doing this and is doing that. Not one of these entities is holding Saudi Arabia accountable. Not one of these nations or these entities is pointing the finger at the Crown Prince or the King of Saudi Arabia to tell him enough is enough.
Indeed. Well, when you look at it through that lens that our guests are from Sana'a just talked about there, Ben Orton, it shows UN complicity. And the only thing that comes to my mind is how Saudi Arabia, along with the U.S., are major contributors when it comes to the funding of the UN. We've known about how Saudi Arabia has actually been excused by the UN when it came to killing children in the war in Yemen and countless of other situations where, they made excuses for Saudi Arabia. And, of course, this sheds another light and another angle to this. Do you think that that is the reason, if you agree with our guest there from Sana'a, that perhaps even the UN is complicit because this siege is not being lifted and people in Yemen are still suffering?
Well, we do know that the pressure of funding has been a significant factor in the United Nations inaction. In fact, the previous Secretary General Ban Ki-moon admitted that Saudi Arabia threatened to withdraw funding after the UN was going to put Saudi Arabia on its list of countries that violate the rights of children. So it's an objective fact that Saudi Arabia and the Western powers have used funding as blackmail to try to prevent the United Nations from taking action against this borderline genocidal war in Yemen. But we also know that inside the United Nations Security Council, which is the institution that has the most power, the U.S. has very frequently used its veto power to prevent any U.N. action. So I think it's very justified to criticize the U.N., but at the end of the day, the weaknesses of the U.N., I think, are reflections of Western imperialism and U.S. hegemony. The fact that the U.S. can use the U.N. to advance its geopolitical interests, and then when the U.N. tries to take actions that may in some way challenge U.S. interests, well, Washington can use its veto in the Security Council to block those resolutions. We've seen the United States many dozens of times has vetoed UN resolutions condemning apartheid Israel's illegal activities and occupation of Palestinian territories. So similarly, if the UN Security Council were to try to take action against Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, it's very likely that the United States and also potentially Britain and France would use their veto power to prevent any UN action against Saudi Arabia. So once again, Riyadh can only carry out this war and kill hundreds of thousands of Yemenis because it has support from Western imperialist powers. And honestly, if the United States were to say tomorrow, we are ending our support for this war, I think the war would end within a few days. But the response from the White House is, of course, the opposite. Instead, Joe Biden is saying, well, we want to improve our relations with Saudi Arabia in order to continue our war on Russia as well. So in Washington, the solution to all of these problems is never less war. It's always more war.
Well, let me open up then this question, which I'm almost sure that maybe you have either read it, Yousef Mari, or you've heard about it at this point, and that is the op-ed that Biden, the U.S. president, has written prior to his visit to the region, titled Why He's Going to Saudi Arabia. I mean, there in itself shows the level of, I don't want to say disillusion, because obviously either Biden wrote it himself or somebody wrote it for him. But it really is a far stretch from the reality. And I begin with this, Yousef Mari, where Biden says, the war in Yemen was escalating, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises with no political process. In Yemen, I named an envoy and engaged with leaders across the region, including the King of Saudi Arabia, to lay the foundation for a truce. What do you think when the U.S. president is saying that?
Well, he's obviously pushing the U.S.'s political agenda, and he's going to say whatever he's going to say to push that agenda. I mean, you have a president who's ignoring the death and the genocide of tens of thousands of innocent people in order to pursue and to continue the Western hegemonic international structure, right? And that's been the case. Biden, he's scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia in the next couple of days, and the reason why he's doing that is the U.S. has a propensity to beef up its allies with military weapons in order to continue Western expansion and in order to continue the U.S.'s interest dominance over the region. But what's interesting about this visit, this visit actually, is that the U.S. and Israel, they're actually laying the groundwork for a new security alliance to be established between the U.S., between Israel, and most of the Arab states, most of the Saudi-backed coalition. And the purpose of this visit is they want to create or connect military technology to combat Yemen. They're actually building a network of radars, detectors, weapon interceptors, and they want to use this military technology, unprecedented military technology, to attack Yemen on demand. And not only attack Yemen, but they also want to counter any missile attacks by the Sana'a government towards Saudi Arabia or toward any of the countries that are waging this aggression on Yemen. And what's even more interesting is that the U.S. and the Israeli entity, they're actually using Yemeni islands, they're using Yemeni territory to build these military bases, to build these detectors, to build these sophisticated state-of-the-art radars. They're using the island of Socotra, they're using the island of Meitun, and this is all Yemeni land that's being used to point its weapons and to point its missiles towards the Yemeni people. So this is an unprecedented event where you have just think of NATO joining forces with the Arab coalition being led by the Israeli entity and the U.S. supreme military technology all joining forces to wage war on Yemen. This is, this is not propaganda. This is actually happening as we speak. So as we speak, in spite of the humanitarian crisis that's taking place on the ground, you have more military activity in preparation to wage an all-out war on Yemen. And from the looks of it, it's going to happen in the near future.
Mm-hmm. We're going to discuss that a little bit more. I need to open this op-ed more, because it's really incredible, Ben Norton, when you think about it. Another very controversial statement coming out of it, in a sense, is how the U.S. president says, after a year of our persistent diplomacy, this truce is now in place. News just came out today, exclusively, of course, internal U.S. discussions on Saudi arms at early stage, decision likely to depend on Saudi efforts to end the war. So you have the U.S. announcing potential arms sales. Biden did sell arms back in November of 2021 to the tune of between $650 to $750 million. So how do you evaluate the way that Biden is presenting himself in this op-ed with this last viewpoint that I just presented?
Well, it's more of the same. Joe Biden claimed repeatedly during his presidential campaign that he would end the war in Yemen. And when he came in January of 2021, Then in February, a few weeks after entering office, he claimed that he had reached a new agreement with Saudi Arabia and he was ending support for all offensive operations. Now, he claimed that the U.S. was continuing support for Saudi defensive operations. But of course, the very nature of the Saudi war is an aggressive war. It is a war that was launched in March 2015, bombing Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, with the support of the U.S., Britain, and France, has carried out tens of thousands of airstrikes. How can an airstrike be defensive? It's not defensive. So we see that from the very beginning, the Biden administration has been the master of trying to use this language that sounds like he's ending the war, that sounds like he's pursuing peace and diplomacy, but all he's really doing is redefining what the U.S. is doing in supporting Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, and then saying that he made progress. And similarly now, he says that he's going to pressure Saudi Arabia to end the war in Yemen and then going to start selling offensive weapons. Are we really supposed to believe that if Saudi Arabia says, oh, we're ending the war in Yemen, but we buy all of these weapons from the U.S., are we really supposed to believe that Saudi Arabia is not going to use those weapons? Then why is it buying those weapons? It's clearly buying those weapons with the intent to use them. And maybe Saudi Arabia says, okay, we have officially ended operations, and then it unofficially continues waging this war. And we also have to be clear, when Biden says that Saudi Arabia is going to engage in diplomacy, does that mean that it's going to recognize the de facto government in Yemen that governs the majority of where the population of Yemen lives, which is the Sana'a government? Is Saudi Arabia ever going to recognize that government? And of course, the answer is very unlikely. Saudi Arabia is still going to recognize the puppet regime, which was unelected in the south, as the illegitimate government of Yemen. So that's not a diplomatic solution. That's just kicking the problem under the rug and pretending like it no longer exists.
Okay, let's break this down with the information you gave us, Yousef Mowry. We're looking at the Socotra Island, where it is reported that the UAE is setting up a military base with Israeli cooperation and perhaps to have Israeli special operatives operating there along with the UAE. What type of purpose does that serve, and what are they doing to execute whatever military purposes they believe it serves them? If you can please explain that to us.
Well, they basically, so here's how it works in Yemen, right? With what's been, you know, has been empirically proven. The U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, they've come to the realization that they will not win the war inside of Yemen. In other words, they understand that they will not be able to topple, they will not be able to dethrone the Sana'a government from power because, one, the Sana'a government has a large portion of support from the Yemeni people, and they've managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the Yemeni people. They've tried over the past 7 years to overthrow, to dethrone the Sana'a government, and they failed miserably across the board to achieve this goal. So now, plan B, if you will, they will no longer try to take over the capital, Sana'a. What they're going to do instead, actually, they're going to try to turn Yemen into another Gaza, whereby Yemen as a nation will be imprisoned. It will be besieged and surrounded with military bases to wage attack on demand anytime that they feel the need to do so. So just because they can't overthrow the government and just because they can't win the hearts and the minds of the Yemeni people, they're resorting to Plan B, which calls for the engulfing the entire nation with military bases and waging attacks anytime the Yemeni government, the Sana'a government, attempts to resuscitate the economy, anytime the Yemeni government attempts to rebuild its military and public institutions. They're basically hell-bent on keeping Yemen in the worst humanitarian crisis until they get the regime change that they want. So unless the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia get the regime change that they so desperately want, they're going to keep the Yemeni people starving to death. They're going to keep this strangling blockade imposed on the country. They're going to continue their airstrikes. They're going to continue their military offensive from all four corners of Yemen. And this is what the Socotra Island is being used for. This is what the island of Ma'un is being used for. This is what the Northwest South is being used for in Yemen. Any place in Yemen, any area that's under the occupation of Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries is going to be used to continue waging this Saudi war on Yemen. And to answer your question, so this is what the plan is right now. Since they can't take over Yemen, since they can't get the regime change that they want, they're basically hell-bent on turning Yemen into another Gaza. They basically want it to be a country without a thriving economy. They basically want want Yemen to be without a military, and they want the country to be divided and in a state of chaos and instability.
When you want to break down the amounts of incentive each entity has in this game, Ben Norton, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word game, in this process, we're looking at the United States, Saudi Arabia, obviously, and we're also looking, obviously, in the increasing role that Israel plays. It appears that the U.S. may be outnumbered when it comes to an incentive to have the scenario that our guest from Sana'a says to be executed, because even if Saudi Arabia, even if the U.S. does not want to pursue this war, Israel is pushing for that scenario that our guest from Sana'a is saying, and I'm sure that you have Saudi Arabia that perhaps maybe even laying out that as a condition in order for the situation or the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to improve, and arms sales being one of those prerequisites of Saudi Arabia. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think so, but the reality is that for the United States, they are, speaking frankly, unfortunately, the United States government does not care about the people of Yemen. It never has. It was waging a drone war that killed many Yemeni civilians. The Trump administration carried out raids that killed Yemeni children. The U.S. government sees Yemen as a chip in a game. I mean, you use the term game. Unfortunately, that's the way these policymakers in Washington see the world. They see countries not as countries representing sovereign people of flesh and blood. They see the countries as potential allies or enemies. And George W. Bush famously said that the perspective of the U.S. government is you're either with us or you're against us. And the U.S. government is trying to force every country around the world to join its alliance in a new Cold War that it's waging on both China and Russia. And of course, Iran is a strategic partner of both China and Russia. And that further incentivizes the U.S. and apartheid Israel to work together to pressure all countries in West Asia to take aggressive actions against Iran, to try to isolate Iran and also, of course, isolate China and Russia. So unfortunately, in terms of what U.S. interests are, the U.S. has no interest whatsoever in protecting the Yemeni people. The Joe Biden administration may claim for public relations purposes and you know, its public speeches that it cares about human rights. But I'm sure that when Biden sits down with Mohammed bin Salman, he's going to say very clearly, look, we're against Iran, we're against China, we're against Russia. You just have to do something publicly to get all of these people criticizing me off of my back. He's going to tell MBS that you should say that you formally ended the war, and we're going to continue as you informally continue this war. And I think the guest from Sana'a is correct that the U.S. strategy is to turn Yemen into a new Gaza and to try to get everyone around the world to just forget about it. Okay. And allow Saudi Arabia to continue occupying it, blockading it, and continuing a war, but a quiet war, so the White House doesn't have to deal with public criticism.
Thank you. Yusuf Mari from Sana'a, journalist and political analyst, thank you. Founder and editor of the independent news website Multipolarista, Ben Norton from Managua. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, relationship between parents and children. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In today's lesson, we'll talk about the relationship between parents and children. When we talk about the relationship between a child and a parent, there are a few issues that we need to look at. Today, we will look at the wishes that children have upon their parents. For instance, a child could be wishing that their parents will understand that I was created for a particular time and not their time. What does this mean? A child could be imagining, like my parent right now is correcting me of a mistake that maybe during my time, that mistake is okay. But during his time or her time, the mistake wasn't okay. So the child wishes that the parent will actually understand the situation that I am in right now. I'm living in a moment whereby it's different times compared to the times that the parents used to live. So this is a point stating that a child sometimes in their heart, they will not be saying it loudly. They might not be saying it verbally to the parent, but they'll be wishing this in their heart. Like, I wish that my parent now would understand that I'm living in a different moment of time than they used to do. So by understanding this point, as a parent, as a guide, as a mother, it will definitely lead you to understanding on how you could correct your child sometimes. Therefore, we need to understand that children or our children do have their wishes sometimes in their lives. And we need to respect that as parents. I'll get back with more points about this in the second chapter of this episode. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to iRib English Radio, and this is A to Z. We've been talking about the relationship between a parent and a child. And on the first episode, we stated a little bit on the wishes a child would have upon their parent. That children do have wishes, actually, against or upon their parents. They're wishing that their parent would understand them. They're wishing that their parent would know what they expect from them. They're wishing that their parents will understand that they're living in a different moments of time. Now, as we continue, we need to know now, the parents that are living with the children, they're guiding them in their life. What are some of the wishes that a parent could have upon their child, upon their children, a mother, a father, a guide, or whoever it might be? They could be having a few wishes upon their children. What are some of the wishes that a parent could have upon their wishes? I will state a few. Among this, one of the wishes that a father could have upon their child is that the father will be hoping that their son or their daughter, whoever it might be, will be better than me, will be better than them, and not only by continuation. Him as a father, he is hoping that my kid is going to be better than me in life, is going to do better than me in life, and not just continuing on what I left. Because I did things in my life, I might have done a few other mistakes or so many mistakes. I'm hoping that my son will come and sit in my chair, but not just do what I used to do, what I did in my previous life. No, I wish that he does better than me. This is among the wishes that we could retrieve from a father's heart sometimes. As we say, the wishes might not be verbal. They might not be saying it with their mouth, or saying it to their kids, but this is among the few wishes a father, a mother, a guide could have in his heart upon their kid. So by understanding these few things as children or as parents, definitely is going to help us realize or understand what is the importance of understanding the relationship between a parent and their children, or between parents and children. We'll meet in this next episode and we'll know more about this. Fia Manila, bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture.
We believe that we are going to face a recession during the winter, given all the headwinds we are facing right now, the energy situation, but also the cost of living situation that is having a strong impact on consumption.
Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow.
We started our meeting with a discussion on the economic situation, which continues to be challenging due to the impact of Russia's military aggression and all the global developments that arise from that.
Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French President Emmanuel Macron has become the highest profile name tarnished by the so-called Uber files, a massive leak of company documents. The whistleblowing appears to detail the ride-hailing company's lawbreaking and collusion with political elites across the West. While economy minister under his predecessor, François Hollande, Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the national labor code. French leftist parliamentarians have openly accused Macron of favoring the interests of an American company over those of his own government. Macron faced similar accusations in 2015 when he guided the sale of French energy giant Alstom to America's General Electric. A defiant Macron shockingly said he would, quote, do it again tomorrow, even though Uber's promises of good jobs and economic prosperity have resoundingly failed in France and elsewhere and caused many indebted taxi drivers to commit suicide.
Taxi drivers are not surprised. We saw that Uber is not good at creating jobs, but for creating a new type of slavery. We love our jobs and our cities, and passengers understood that, and Uber has lost here. Uber dangerously does not respect the laws over and over again, while Macron needs this type of behind-the-scenes lobbies to inflict his type of politics.
Macron has often been accused of attempting the Uberization of all of French society. The accuracy of that criticism appears more just than ever.
Uber has reaped the consequence of their nonsense in France because the government refused to control them with our laws. Uber is more expensive than taxis now and not popular. The Uber market can compete with the taxi market, but there has to be regulation.
The scandal is a reminder that while Western liberal economics claims to be based on fair, free market competition, political corruption is routinely employed to create monopolies, inequalities, and to subvert democratic laws. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Outside Belgium's largest asylum application center, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city center. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the center to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from long time ago. When you claim asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine. On the face of it, this might look like a Belgium problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination? That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence and with our support, they need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 is considered as one of President Biden's biggest failures. The NBC News revealed that the White House and U.S. agencies have started discussions on how to handle the anniversary of withdrawal to prevent further political damage to the president. Afghan experts believe that by reversing the truth, the Biden administration will try to sweep their failures under the carpet and turn a blind eye on the miseries of Afghans whose lives were spoiled by messy withdrawal.
The U.S. and Western propaganda have always had the skill of broadcasting historical events in a way they want. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has not been an exception to this rule. It's clear that the U.S. will whitewash its withdrawal mission in its anniversary to keep their global prestige. While we and the world witnessed the U.S. mess in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as a result of their failure, a political system collapsed, NATO-Afghanistan agreement was broken, and dozens of Afghans were devastated. Most importantly, the U.S. lost its reputation as NATO gendarme.
Shahir, who is in hiding, was left behind by the U.S. He and his family members were asked to come to the airport, but weren't airlifted. He is angry with the U.S., and is still shocked from the sorrowful, frustrating, and insulting evacuation process. He says he feels betrayed by the U.S.
When I made it to the gate of the airport along with my family members, the NATO forces were firing bullets and tear gas everywhere. Inside Kabul airport, we witnessed four Afghans shot dead and three others injured by the U.S. forces. People were panicked, running everywhere. While I was showing my documents, NATO forces hit me with sticks and it started bleeding. Then I gave up as I felt insulted and betrayed by the U.S.
The U.S. 20-year devastating war on Afghanistan ended with a disastrous withdrawal. Several Afghans fell from American aircrafts. Some were shot dead and wounded. Many children were lost. Moreover, a U.S. airstrike hit a house in the airport neighborhoods. killing 10 family members, including women and children. The chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan in 2021 reminds Afghans of those ugly and tragic days. People here blame the ill-prepared U.S. for spoiling the lives of thousands of Afghan people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protesters from Palestine Action Scotland scaling the roof of one of the world's largest arms companies in Glasgow, demanding that the facility be shut down. They're soon arrested by Scottish police, but they've done the damage they intended.
They've obviously realized that asking nicely has not worked. The government hasn't made any lasting change, and they have taken measures into their own hands where the government has chosen not to.
The activists, who were taken in court and released later, accused the Paris-headquartered multinational TALS group of making an array of lethal weapons that help enforce the Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. The Watchkeeper drone is one of the group's deadly products, developed in collaboration with a notorious Israeli weapons company that's been the target of these activists for years now.
In 2019, TALS made 8.3 billion euros in profit, and that wasn't just off the suffering and oppression of Palestinians. It was from the oppression of refugees worldwide. Their business is oppression, their business is genocide, and they're willing to sacrifice millions upon millions of lives for profit.
The building behind me used to house the headquarters of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. Earlier this year, and after 2 years of relentless direct action, Palestine Action say, they forced the company to close down and leave, getting one step closer to ending Israel's arms trade in Britain.
That came only 5 months after the company was forced to close up shop in the northwestern city of Oldham, Greater Manchester. Elbit Systems still has 8 more sites in the UK. Palestine Action say they will continue to throw a spanner in the works of Elbit and companies that collaborate with it until they're all closed and until Palestine is free. Saeed Puriza, London.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a 2-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
As the race for the leadership of the UK ruling Conservative Party heats up, the fight for who will become Britain's next Prime Minister turns ugly. With bitter exchanges, leaked dodgy dossiers, and attacks on rivals' policies, the contest could quickly turn into a large-scale brawl. A flurry of weekend announcements has put the total count of top job hopefuls at 11, a large number filled with big and small names. Rishi Sunak tops with the most Tory MP supporters so far, with pro-Brexit Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt coming in second. However, critics say a long drawn-out contest will deepen economic uncertainty amid a cost-of-living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly, Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute. And I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. It's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. But, you know, I mean, you just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate, who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much. Unless there's a snap election and then, say, like, Labour take over something, I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Afsana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very interesting and important question. This question is kind of related to an ethical topic, and that question revolves around the meaning of asceticism, or zuhud, which we know is one of the principal and very central virtues within Islam, right? You know, there's in ethics, Islamic ethics, there's a lot of virtues which have been enumerated and which we have been encouraged to adopt, right? For example, there's sidq, truthfulness, ikhlas, sincerity, right? And, you know, vigilance, muraqabah. You know, one of these virtues which have been lauded and have been praised and we have been encouraged to adopt is zuhud or asceticism. But there's kind of an ambiguity surrounding this word, and a lot of times people miscomprehend what this truly means, right? So when we think of being ascetic, we think of, our mind immediately goes to, you know, shunning the world and not, you know, owning any kind of material property. You know, we obviously, our mind first, the image that comes in our mind is of a, like some sort of, you know, Buddhist monk who has renounced the world and lives up in the mountains, or some Hindu, you know, Brahmin who, you know, has renounced the world and walks around, you know, in his loincloth, begging for food, right? But is this really the true meaning of zuhud in Islam or not? Fortunately, we can investigate this question and derive and abstract its and the answer to the question from the Quran and the Hadith. So let's look at one of the Hadith which have been narrated from the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, regarding the meaning of zuhud and asceticism. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has been narrated to have said that asceticism from worldly pleasures means to cut short one's hopes of this world. So right off the bat in this hadith, we see that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has kind of alluded to the fact that zuhud is not a sort of activity per se of the body, right? So it doesn't imply taking all your stuff and throwing it in the garbage, right? It doesn't mean going to your job and handing in your resignation to your job and say, I don't want to have anything to do with, you know, this job, and I don't really need money anymore. I'm renouncing the world and being an ascetic. No. It's an action of the heart. It means not to hope in the world. Az-zuhdu fi dunya qasrul amal. Meaning not hoping in the world. Not having any hope in the world. Meaning even though we have money, we're using it, we have a job, right? But we shouldn't rely on that. Our reliance should be on God. In continuation, the Prophet says, to be grateful for every single bounty, to have piety, and to keep away from all that Allah has prohibited. Right? So it actually implies being thankful for the blessings we have, not, you know, relinquishing them. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the true meaning of Zuhud. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
زیارت قدیر. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Hello, dear listeners. Since we are passing through the 10 auspicious days of Wilayat, marking the completion of divine favors and the perfection of faith on the historic plain of Qadir Khum, where on the 18th of Zilhijjah in 10 AH, as per God's commandment, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon his progeny, while returning from the farewell pilgrimage, declared Imam Ali, peace be upon him, as the vicegerent, we present to you the ziyara, or standard form of salutation for the commander of the faithful on this occasion. Because of its length and its thought-provoking content, we have divided the Ziyarat al-Ghadir into four parts. The translation was undertaken by Dr. Ali Ghuli Gharai, director of the English section of the Quranic Translation Institute in the holy city of Qom, who had earlier translated the Holy Quran into English. Please stay tuned for the first part. It is recommended to perform a bath, and after putting on clean clothes, one should turn towards the holy tomb of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, and recite, peace on Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah, the seal of the prophets, the chief of the emissaries, the elect of the Lord of all the worlds, who was entrusted by Allah with his revelations and his prime commandments, and who is the seal of the previous prophecies and inaugurator of what is yet to come and is the custodian of all that. May Allah's mercy and his blessings, bounties, and greetings be upon him. Peace on the prophets of Allah, his apostles, archangels, and his righteous servants. Peace be on you, O commander of the faithful, chief of the legatees, heir to the knowledge of the prophets, friend of the Lord of all the worlds, and my guardian and guardian of all the faithful. May Allah's mercy and his blessings be upon you. Peace on you, O my guardian, O commander of the faithful, O Allah's trustee on his earth, his envoy amongst his creatures, and his conclusive testament to his servants. Peace on you, O Allah's true religion and his straight path.